The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights.
Whether that's live music at an historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laugh as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. Let's give a shout out to our super producer, Mr. Max Williams.
Oh.
You know him, you love him. My one and only co-host, Mr. Noel Brown. They call me Ben Noel. We ran into an interesting situation with a lovely two-part episode on the history of music sampling last week. And at the very beginning, man, we did a classic Ridiculous History joke, right?
Where the fake out.
Yeah, the fake out. Mm-hmm. One of us always does one of those fake outs if we can. And I think we got to our pal Max, dude.
Oh, yeah. it'll happen. We're pretty, we kind of insist upon ourselves.
We push people. Yeah. Yeah, we push.
And yeah, I think we made some toothpick jokes, tiny cubes of cheese, mm-hmm. et cetera. Mm-hmm. And we had a little sub conversation before we got into the real deal about the history of sampling in music, about, you know, the different types of free samples that you get at, like, say, you know, you and I like to go to a lot of Asian grocery stores out on Buford Highway here where we live, and they'll have little tiny cups of noodle soups or, like you said, kimchi or whatever it might be. And then you've got, you know, your run-of-the-mill Kroger, like some new brand of whatever it might be, thin rice cracker.
Gluten-free mac and cheese cups. Yeah.
Exactly. Or balls, perhaps. And sometimes there'll be, you know, someone actually grilling some tiny portions of meats.
Which I love.
It does feel a little extra, doesn't it? Like, yeah. Than just getting, you know, a cold piece of cheese or something like that. Yeah. But a little George Foreman, some kind of hot plate. It also feels like it has a little bit more, let's just call it, I don't know, grandiosity to it. It's mm-hmm. a little more of an event. And then certain grocery stores get reputations for being the one to go to for the best free samples, like our beloved Trader Joe's.
Trader Joe's, H Mart on a Saturday, which is considered a Korean grocery store. It's where you go to get a lot of cool, fresh ingredients you might not find somewhere else. And they do it big with the samples. College age Ben Bolin owes you, H Mart Empire, a huge thank you, as well as Trader Joe's. Good call, Noel, because you helped me not pay for lunch for many years.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I'm still a little embarrassed when I see, because at H Mart, they're always going to have someone cooking the stuff too. And oh, yeah. I stand there.
Well, like I said, it's sort of a mark of a little bit more expertise than someone just holding out a cup. And you got to give them props where props are due. Last little aside about our personal experience with the free samples. I used to work at a guitar shop in Augusta, Georgia. And there was this cute little old lady named Miss Tabor. And she would always send us across the street to for us young fellas who worked there. We were like, you know, in high school to get. She would describe them, go to Fresh Market and get me one of those little cups of coffee.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. At Fresh Market, their whole thing was sampling all of their different coffees in these tiny little mouthwash cups. And she wanted us to fetch her one in our car. And I mean, to transport one of those, you know, like the cup holders, I hate to tell you, are not meant for these not little designed cups of coffee. So we'd be lucky if we didn't scald ourselves, you know, on the journey back.
And so a few days after we do these jokes, and a few days after we have recorded our two-part episode on sampling, shout out to our research associate, Jeff Bartlett, Max comes back and says, hey, guys, this... You didn't out and out say it got to you, but you said, hey, guys, recently when we talked about sampling, you kept joking that the episode was not about music, but free samples. So you know what? Max beat me here. Here's your fucking episode on free samples.
Hey, man, nobody directly asked you to do this.
No one did. Above and beyond.
Classic, I just want to just say, I finished editing and then I immediately sat down and wrote this brief out. There was no period between. Like, I didn't do anything between. It went one to one right there.
Well, I love that. And last thing before we really dive into this topic, which is a lot deeper than you might think. I just realized we never said one thing in the history of sampling in music episodes. We talked about the Fairlight sampler or the Fairlight, you know, music computer that a lot of luminaries used in the 80s, big old touchscreen thing with like a light pen, they called it. That is where the term sampling came from, was that company, basically the creators of the Fairlight, started using the term sample as referring to the little units of sound.
That's good. Yeah. And I rewatched the Questlove hip hop stuff and we talked about Kool Herc, but really, if you want the full story, do check out that Drunk History. It's just, it holds up. He's such a good storyteller. Okay. Free samples as food. Everybody knows the score, I think, these days. They're considered one of the most reliable tactics you can use to bolster sales of a product, especially if it's a new thing on the market and people might not want to spend, you know, $5, $10, whatever dollars to purchase it. And Carl Smallwood, writing for todayifoundout.com, says, quote, you see, free samples don't just work because they give customers a chance to try something without the barrier of cost stopping them, but they also take advantage of the fact that humans seem hardwired to, and this is true, guys, feel like we should do something in return when someone does something for us. This is why if people sell you stuff on the street, they try to hand you something and get you to hold it at some point. I don't maybe want to use the hard C word, but there was a commune that used to send operatives out in Little Five Points, kind of Bohemian-esque area in Atlanta back in the day. This place was called Zendik Farms. And what Zendik Farms would do is they would send people that they thought were charming or attractive and already in their organization that I'm not explicitly calling a cult. They would talk about how great Zendik Farms is for creatives and so on. They would hand you a CD. They would hand you like a newsletter or a zine or something. And as you said, okay, well, that's great. I hope you have a great day. Not super interested. I'm going to go. They would say, oh, and it's a donation of $25 for the CD.
Right.
It's not a donation.
Yeah, sort of like a, in theory, a pay what you will thing, which is even in, you know, music, right? Like when Radiohead came out with In Rainbows, they did like a pay what you will model. And I don't think they released the amount of money they made on it, but I would be willing to bet that most people, if they had it and were a fan of Radiohead, would give a little bit, you know, chip a little bit in just for the privilege of having this basically free album. It's also a tactic that's used pretty, arguably for better or for worse, depending on who you are, with like NPR pledge drives.
Oh, yeah.
They sort of make you feel like, hey, you know, that whole year of stuff we've been giving you for free. Well, now's the time to pay it forward or to pay back into the system. You got to give.
You got to give. A lot of people give. So the other Sith Lord version of this would be unscrupulous actors like timeshare salespeople, right? They offer you a free vacation so they can get you for 4 or 5 hours. But yeah, there's a weird psychological thing that works pretty much across humanity. Sampling or giving out free samples is a pretty innocuous way to leverage that psychological phenomenon. And what's really cool here is that there's more history to it than you might imagine. There's quite a story. Let's go back to Carl Smallwood, who says, Carl is arguing that our modern concept of free samples, you know, what we call free samples, cheese at the grocery store and so on, it seems pretty recent, but the concept of free samples has been around since, what was that, Noel, like the 14th century?
Yeah, the 14th century indeed. And it is referenced in a poem by William Langland called Piers Plowman, which refers to the concept of a test for a newt, which in modern English would probably translate to something like a taste for naught, you know, or for nothing. I said a newt. I kind of knew it was pronounced naught, but it's spelled differently. It's spelled N-O-U-H-T. And we know in those lilting old English poems, they love a newt and a boot and a scoot, you know, and futh and luth and all that good stuff.
Yeah. So you would, in the poem, there's this line about all these barflies basically going up to get a taste for nothing, with the idea that if you wet your whistle a little bit, you'll say, okay, I'll pay for the full pint or whatever. And this shows that for a long time, salespeople throughout different cultures have known you give a little to get a little bit more, right? And because it's so old, we as a civilization have no idea who first came up with this. Was there like a caveman who needed to sell some rocks and said, I'll give you a small rock for free?
Right.
And, you know, like it's so basic and primal. But we do know there is one guy who we could consider kind of one of the fathers of the modern version, Benjamin T. Babbitt, which is a fun name, Babbitt.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer? Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Mint Mobile.
You know, Ben, I gotta say, one of the best parts about spring cleaning is that post-clean clarity you get where you're like, man, how have I been living like this? What's wrong with me?
You're right, Noel. It's kind of like when you find out you've been paying a fortune for wireless when Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan.
It's time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month.
To get this new customer offer and your new three-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
That's mintmobile.com/ridiculous. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
$45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only.
Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply.
See Mint Mobile for details.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's a very fun name. He was born in the early 19th century, was an inventor, a, you know, forward thinker, a business type, was very wealthy and was, you know, quite highly regarded because he was really good at promoting his ideas, which I think, you know, it's one thing to be an idea man, you know, or an idea person, but it's another thing to be able to single-handedly have an amazing idea for an innovation or whatever it is, but also then know how to market it. And it's the rare combination of both of those skills that lead to, like, luminaries in this world, like P.T. Barnum, you know, and stuff like that, or perhaps Thomas Edison. You know, he also had a flair for the grand, you know, in terms of, like, putting his product out there and insisting that he be the center of attention regarding all of that stuff. Edison, that is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Edison also is far from a perfect guy. You could say he's a very effective popularizer, right? And those are similar observations have been made by critics of folks like Steve Jobs. But you're right, selling the thing is an entirely different skill set to creating the thing. And it's fairly rare to see somebody who can do both of those skill sets very well. This guy, Babbitt, he's a soap boy. He makes a name in the soap industry, but he has a lot of other patents because he's always working with that beautiful mind of his. And you can see that he's respected for a ton of his prolific inventions. Like, he worked a lot with powders. The way Danny DeVito and Always Sunny in Philadelphia is into sludges, this guy was into powders. He made baking powder, soap powder, other varieties of soap. And
there was a time where powders was like the wave of the future. You know what I mean? Yeah, it was like, oh, it's portable. It's powders. You know? Oh, my God. It's sort of like the idea of like a meal in pill form.
Oh, we should do a history of soap. Oh, man, that's a weird one. Mm-hmm. For a device, for an invention meant to keep you clean, soap has a dirty past.
No questions. Yeah. I mean, not to mention, you know, the whole how it was made. And,
yeah.
Know, human bodies and stuff like that.
We'll
but we digress. The idea here for something is still, you make a good point, Ben, because soap is an age-old technology, let's call it. So how does someone set their age-old technology aside from, like, the millions or however many, you know, many dozens at the time of other available products that are exactly the same on the market? You know, a lot of bluster can help, you know, marketing, let's call it. Sorry, how do I really feel about marketing? Yeah, it's a little bit bluster. Yeah, there's some bravado involved in, like, you know, talking a big game about your product. But it's another thing to literally, maybe not literally, but put your money where your mouth is. Say, well, hey, you know, I've said these things. You can believe me or not, but the proof is in the pudding or the tiny cube of soap.
He really did it. I think you're on the money. He literally did it. He is now credited as the first person to not only sell soap in individual bars, but to do like an ice cream truck with it. He would make these really visually striking, bright, colorful streetcars, and they would drive around town and they would be followed by these musicians who had these custom songs about how amazing Babbitt soap was. And then as people would come out into the streets to see what the hubbub was, he would give away bars of soap, literally hand them to people, and they had different packaging than the ones you bought in the store. All the packaging had was a tagline that, you know, like, words of Babbitt that said, a fair trial is all I ask. And then, you know, people aren't going to throw the soap back. It's free soap.
It's free soap. And also, you got to think, now we think of these kinds of, let's call it a marketing stunt, you know, as like, oh God, you know what I mean? We get it. We know what this is about. You're trying to sell us something. But at the time, this was like a free parade. You know what I mean? Like, with the accompanying free stuff. I always think of like the Joker and the Tim Burton Batman, you know, like throwing throwing Joker bucks out to the crowd and then gassing them all. See, I obviously have a very dark view of marketing strategies, but it's interesting, right? Because he really was, you know, he had a service that was readily available in many other, you know, forms in terms of soap, but he differentiated it. And he also, you know, was like, here, try it out for yourself. See what you think.
And people loved it because he knew one of the number one things that happens when you are shopping is the association of familiarity, right? I'm spending my hard-earned cheddar, maybe on some cheddar. I want to go with the cheese I recognize. So now he's giving people a free experience. They're going to have a positive association or connotation with this. And he is also going to hit them. He's going to love bomb them with other advertising techniques. You know, he's got stuff like he kind of rips off cleanliness is godliness or puts a riff on it and says cleanliness is the scale of civilization on packaging. If you're a customer, he will let you have a tour of the factory. And guess what that tour ends with? Free samples, bro.
Can I just say those taglines are very of their era, you know, because now they're just not pithy or zippy at all. You know, they seem very like, I am providing a valuable service to you. You know, like that is that's the selling point. That's the elevator pitch. Now you got to dress it up and make it a lot more wow factory. But this worked. And to the point where the name BT Babbitt became so ubiquitous that there's this, you know, it's these kinds of stories of the stuff of marketing legend, let's say, and, you know, very much probably used by the company for a long time and proliferated. But this idea that Babbitt came upon a humble shoeshine lad whose name was also B.T. Babbitt. And the kid, apparently, when told by B.T. Babbitt himself that his name was also that, said, did your mama get your name off a soapbox, too? Aww. Isn't that a cute story? What a cute story. But it's also like, nope, I'm a soap mogul and you're poor. Now shine my shoes.
I hope you tipped him, Ben. Go Ben.
Also, probably not true.
Yeah, exactly. Apocryphal is the word that's used in the article that we're citing. Also from today, today I found out article.
I do want to say that anecdote, we weren't able to confirm it. It does have the air of one of those off-the-cuff anecdotes that corporate types give when they're doing a conference or a speech. Yeah. Like, you know, what are we really selling? We're selling stories, right? And I'd like to tell you a story.
Lies.
Well, oh, come on. They're not all lies. Let's go to another version. Coca-Cola, before we get into the grocery store, we're still not in grocery store free sample days. Before we get there, we got to talk about Coca-Cola, which is an absolute juggernaut in the world. And of course, the hometown of Coca-Cola is the fair metropolis of Atlanta, which is, I think, a little bit more famous for being the home of ridiculous history. But good hustle, Coke. Good hustle.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Well said. Well said, man.
Thanks, man.
Yes, this is all the way back in 1886. I think many, you know, we've all heard the story. It was created by a pharmacist named John Stith Pemberton, which, of course, the original formula, I believe, contained some amounts of cocaine, if I'm not mistaken.
And also, yes, you heard that correctly. It's not Sith. It's Stith, S-T-I-T-H.
Yeah. Exactly. But he was definitely the lord of Coke, the lord of syrup, because the recipe was syrup, carbonated water, and again, in this early versions of it, there were some stimulants. But like anything new, you know, people aren't immediately, you know, drawn to new things. Maybe that's the case now, everyone having to have the latest tech or the fastest thing or whatever. But back then, there was a lot of suspicion around new things, you know? People didn't like new things. They wanted the old ways.
Well, also, this is a new kind of drink, too, with this carbonation, these different flavors. And yes, it did contain a little bit of cocaine, I believe. But the thing is, because this is so new, and because there's so many other beverages that people are familiar with, he's not able to sell a lot of this. It costs a nickel for a glass, and you know, they're much smaller than the modern cans, 12-ounce cans that you would see today. But still, he's only selling like 9 drinks and a nickel a pop. He says it's not sustainable. And here we see the interaction between the inventor and the marketer, right? Between the Tesla and the Edison, as it were. There's in 1888, 2 years later, a guy named Asa Griggs Candler buys the Coca-Cola company, and he says, you know what? I remember the idea of free drink tickets. It's something Pemberton's numbers guy introduced earlier. And he says, let's run with it. And there's a cool article you can read in Wired about this. Candler is believed to have created the first ever coupon. And the coupon was simple. Go wherever Coca-Cola is sold, hand them this little piece of script, and boom, you saved yourself a nickel. You got a glass of Coca-Cola. We'll see you again soon.
Goodwill earned. Cha-ching.
Mm-hmm, just so. And these, like, they continue this program from 1894 to 1913. They mail out coupons to drugstores, random customers, if they had their addresses. Because remember, this is before the day of big data. And Coca-Cola itself estimates that during that two decades, 1 in 9 people in the United States were given a free drink because of these coupons. And although they were, you know, ostensibly losing a nickel every time, they were making so much more money because people kept buying. And you know what this reminds me of? And I don't know if they had this, because you grew up in Augusta, right? I don't know if they had this there. Coca-Cola always in the Georgia area would do these things where you could twist off a top of a soda bottle. You might get a free Coke, or you would get a code that you could put on a Coca-Cola account that would earn you stuff in the Coca-Cola store online. They would give you free Six Flags tickets or discounts. Totally. If you've got a can. They're still doing it. It's still a coupon system.
They're in league. They're in cahoots, the Six Flags and the Cokes of the world, not to be confused with the Coke brothers. But it's true. I mean, that idea of the coupon is also a way, this is a little bit more modern, but that a lot of breweries here in Atlanta got around being able to sell beer directly to the public. They would have this little coupon system.
That's right, yeah.
You know, and that's actually something that's still used in places where marijuana sale is like somewhat legal, but not fully legal. Mm-hmm. They'll like give you a little card and then you kind of like get the marijuana product as a free gift.
Or like, yeah, I remember those. There's another one, because these kind of strategies happen all around the world, folks. There's another one in the Netherlands where cannabis laws are a little bit less restrictive, but they still have these strange legal hoops that folks have to jump through. You can go to what's called a cafe where you can get drinks like coffee, alcoholic beverages, juices, whatever, and then you can also consume cannabis in that cafe, but that cafe can't sell you cannabis. You literally go across the street to this other place that only sells that, and the same guy owns both of them.
Right.
they have the same staff, you know? So back to these coupons. We know they work. By 1913, and this is, again, per Coca-Cola themselves, 8.5 million people use these coupons. 8.5 million free doses, glasses of Coca-Cola.
Servings, let's call them.
Servings, there we go. And fast forward, this is a huge part of the engine that drove Coca-Cola to sell 1.9 billion drinks per day in over 200 countries by 2020. Geography nerds. Jeff, if you're listening, I clocked it as well. You'll find this interesting. The United Nations only recognizes about 192 or 193 countries. So Coca-Cola is selling in countries that the UN doesn't recognize.
That's insane. That's pretty interesting. Not to mention, you know, the fact that, remember how Coca-Cola kind of got around like even like war issues by making Fanta in Germany because they used like apple scraps. Anyway, Coca-Cola's figured it out. They cracked the code. And they did that partially with the help of free samples. Another empire, a product empire that did that is the Wrigley Empire. You may know it because of the titular field in Chicago, or you may know it from like a stick of Juicy Fruit.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer.
Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And, of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so we'll start in the late 1860s. This guy, William Wrigley Jr., he's a little bit of a Dennis the Menace character growing up. He's a rapscallion. He runs away from home. He gets expelled from school when they pull him back. And so he gets sent to work in his father's soap factory. Soap has done a lot for free samples. He eventually says, look, this isn't for me. He's very young at this time, by the way. He's like 13. So he says, look, I'm not a soapman. I don't need to be out here stirring vats all day. Old man, Wrigley Jr. I'll stay in the system, but I'm an agent of change. So he becomes a child soap salesman for his dad. And he just like Babbitt before him, he has a flair for this. He knows how to put on the show that results in the sale.
Yeah, another one of these apocryphal kind of stories, the idea that Wrigley Jr., who started the William Wrigley Jr. Company in 1891, had a song in his heart and $32 in his pocket, and he founded a company off of nothing but good old-fashioned, you know, stick-to-itiveness and moxie, right?
Yeah, I mean, whether or not that is true, and it's probably not. He definitely had other money, right? Because it's kind of like when you hear a lot of business moguls say, hey, I started from nothing, you know? As a matter of fact, I had to sell off some of the Class A stock that my grandfather gave me. These were tough times. It's not quite the same. You know what I mean? Drake didn't really start from the bottom. And that's not to take away from their success. It's just a thing that needs to be acknowledged. As we found, Wrigley Jr. may have had his $32, but it was definitely added to the $5,000 check that his uncle gave him, which, if we want to inflation calculate, runs to about $130,000 today.
Yeah, that's like, you know, Trump startup money,
right?
From, you know, that he, anyway, it's no, but he didn't, but he made it, he made it go.
No, but he didn't start with gum, right? Because if you're a sports person, you associate Wrigley with Wrigley Field. If you're not, I always assume people associate them with the gum.
Oh, 100%. Good old Juicy Fruit. Good stuff. And it's basically the same branding. And I think roughly the same recipe is it's always it's been, you know, for a very, very long time. If it ain't broke, don't fix it and all of that.
But he didn't start with gum. He started, and this is almost, I wonder if his dad took it as an act of betrayal. He started selling soap. And it's like, hey, come on, son. I own a soap factory. What are you doing? He followed in Babbitt's footsteps a lot. And he also said, look, I know that people might not want to carry my goods. I'm the new kid on the block. And I am in a market that has low profit margins. And there are a lot of other soap makers out there. There are a lot of other people selling soap. So he starts giving away stuff. But he doesn't just give away like bars of soap that say, hey, give me a fair shot. He gives away baking powder. People still love powder, to your point, Noel.
Yeah, for sure.
He gives away umbrellas.
That's a weird turn.
Yeah, I guess he just got a good deal on some umbrellas, you know? And so the thing that really helps him is that baking powder is experiencing this vogue. It's in the zeitgeist. If you're giving away free baking powder, quite by accident, probably, you're giving away something that is now seen as pretty neat and valuable.
Well, he was a good way of market testing, right? Like he would see which giveaway was the most popular and then ultimately figured out how to kind of pivot, as they say, you know, his business, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's a great way to put it. So the baking powder became a huge hit. And people were requesting the baking powder more than they were requesting the soap. Like in the story about ranch dressing, how people would go to Hidden Valley and say, hey, we don't want a vacation at your dude ranch, but we want some of that special sauce. So he goes, like, just like you said, man, he says, okay, we're not going to make soap. We'll have some soap if people want it, but now we're baking powder people.
Okay, so now he's making baking powder, but he's also still looking for other giveaway items. You know, you mentioned umbrellas. Chewing gum became a very popular one. In fact, so popular that he decided, you know what? Maybe this baking powder thing isn't quite what the hot new buzz on the street is. It's chewing gum now. So he flipped once again and entirely pivoted his business to chewing gum. And that's the Wrigley Company that we know today.
Which is a strange story, right? It's not one that I think a lot of people know when they buy chewing gum. And the gum that he was selling was manufactured by a place called Zeno Company. And Zeno was doing the typical manufacturing process for chewing gum at the time, which is they used paraffin and spruce, and then they would add other ingredients, right? He changed the game and he changed the recipe. He said, let's stick out.
He sure did. And I mentioned Juicy Fruit because that was the kind of first. I mean, if you hear about, you think paraffin and spruce, I guess the spruce is going to be kind of a minty vibe, perhaps. But that doesn't sound super appetizing. It sounds like to me more the chewiness of the gum was the novelty that stuck. For, you know, to leave no pun behind, as we always try to do. The flavor was kind of secondary.
Yeah, yeah. It's more like the experience, right? Like the chew of it. And the spruce sap is, you know, not super great. You don't see it in a lot of flavorings today. And paraffin wax was petroleum derived. So not the best flex. Yeah.
No?
Interesting story about Juicy Fruit. This is a tangent. I can't remember if we mentioned it on air. The reason it's called Juicy Fruit is because that flavor does not exist in nature. Early food scientists made it up and were like, tastes like something.
It's vaguely fruit flavored. It's not exactly citrusy, you know, and that's the funny thing about it is it like it's juicy fruit. That's what it is. And I don't know, it's a very image rich kind of name too. You sure. think of juicy and you think of it like, you know, a nice chewy, juicy piece of gum. It's kind of gross actually, but I can see how it worked. A few months later, he decided to give the folks still using spruce sap a run for their money and came out with Spearmint, a much more pleasant tree-derived products.
Yeah, I'm... God, I hate Spearmint. I don't know why, but it's just...
I mean, comparatively, though.
Yeah, comparatively to, like, spruce and oil. Yeah. So from the World's Columbian Exposition in 1893 all the way to the 20th century, William Wrigley Jr. is going hard on the paint. He's traveling back and forth across the continent. He is promoting these gums, and then he's also still promoting these giveaway things. You thought umbrellas were a big deal, folks? Ridiculous historians. This guy's giving away like pocket knives in St. Louis, lamps in Poughkeepsie, fishing tackle over at Albuquerque, measuring scales, because why not? I feel like
why not? Just indeed,
deal on something like he knew some random wholesaler or some guy who was crooked at the ports.
It does kind of feel like that to a degree. Yeah. Sort of like, you know, this the story you hear about Tommy Wiseau, the guy that created that, you know, cult classics, the Room, that he was like selling leather jackets, you know, that seemingly maybe fell off a truck.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, and there's still a mystery about him, isn't there?
To some degree, yeah.
This guy, Wrigley, somewhere around this time, he said, I need to know more about the mind of the customer. I know people will spend money when they feel that they have been given something and they feel a familiarity. They like stuff that they already recognize. But I'm starting to think that because it's not a huge purchase, like a car or even like a steak, I think people just buy this on a whim. So he would go to the people who sell gum, and he's the one who figured out that you should put gum at the front, right? Gum at the register. So as people are leaving, they've already spent money, right? And they're already paying money out.
Well, that's interesting. That really is an innovation that, you know, somebody had to come up with, I imagine. But like all of those kind of low ticket items that are just sort of like a casual buy, you know what I mean? It could be whether like your candy or whatever, but it's all the things that you're waiting to check out and you see, hey, why not? Why wouldn't I? Why shouldn't I have it? You know,
right. I've done just, well today.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to give me a pack of juicy fruit.
And it's funny because you know what this makes me wonder? A question for everybody listening, for the three of us. How frequently or how rarely do you go into the grocery store and just get the one thing?
No. As we know the psychology of the layout of the grocery store. And knowing it and grappling with it psychologically are two different things. Because I am a sucker for just passing. Oh, look at that dinosaur-shaped sippy cup. You know, like, oh, yeah. I'll get that. Or like, oh, look, a foam football with a little fin on the back that you can, I'll throw that to, you know, the neighbor kid. You know, sure, I no. But it's just, why not? It's just silly, goofy stuff like that. Or, you know, some cereal or snack innovation item.
I'm bad with produce that I've never tried before. I'm the guy walking through and saying, dragon fruit? I bet I could do something with it. I could figure that out.
Well, we've kind of come back around full circle to the supermarket, you know? Mm-hmm. That's how we all in the modern day, I guess, experience free samples. There's a lot of times it's like, you know, because we don't go that many places and we certainly don't have door-to-door salesmen coming knocking on our door trying to offer us a free sample of some, you know, wild new product. Not typically. Usually it'll be like maybe at a trade show or like some, like a, you know, a con of some kind or maybe, you know, a fair, perhaps you might, or, you know, another example is at the mall. You ever see those free orange chicken samples, you know?
I was waiting for food courts to come in because when our office was in a different part of Atlanta, it's very close to a mall that had a heck of a food court. And I would just go to the food court sometimes for lunch, which is an experience It's an experience I wouldn't do every day today. But yeah, free samples are important. And before we wrap up this story, let's shout out some of the other crazy stuff Wrigley did. He put all of his money into this in 1907 when the economy was dodgy. So he made a real gamble and it did pay off. Between 1911 and 1915, he bought out Zeno, the folks who had been making the gum he was selling. And then he did some absolutely bonkers stuff. He mailed free gum to every address in the U.S. telephone books.
Jeez,
he sent every kid 2 sticks of gum, not on their first, but on their second birthday. Like the specificity of that is brilliant.
Wait, why on their second birth? Are they trying to make a lifelong gum chewer? I guess that's more for the parents, really, right?
Yeah, I think you're right. But then also he probably was thinking 2 years old might be old enough to establish a sense memory, even if he didn't use that language. Right.
Well, that's interesting, Ben, because the same year Wrigley he did some kind of benevolent stuff. He offered stock back to his employees, which was a pretty interesting thing. Talk about free samples to help make somebody feel committed to your brand, right?
Yeah, and that's why he took the company public. He became chairman of the board. He did like a succession thing and turned the presidency over to one of his children. In this case, it was his son, Philip, in 1925. He passed away in 1932, 70 years old. He was worth about $34 million at that time. So he's quite successful. And he is definitely studied in sales and marketing classes today, right? Because people want to be that kind of maverick, that pioneer of the hearts and minds. And now we come to it. Like the lesson, if lesson there be, is that free samples absolutely 100% do work. Oh, Costco. Guys, we should get a group Costco card.
Yeah, I've always thought it was too exclusive. Like, don't you have to have some clout or something to get into Costco? Can anybody join?
Anybody can join. Just get a pony up the Capitol. And I guess you got to need like 12 pounds of rutabagas at a time rutabagas. Yeah.
What even is a rutabaga is my question. So yeah, I mean, throughout this whole thing, we're talking about psychology. We're talking about, I give you something, you give me your money for the rest of your life. You know what I mean? But you're getting something in return. And there is this sense of goodwill that comes along with that exchange. And again, we see it every day. In modern times, it's stuff like a money back guarantee, maybe, or like these mattresses that you get online, like Casper or whatever, not a sponsor, that offer you no questions asked return policy. That is sort of an equivalent of a free sample. We're giving you the thing. Obviously, the barrier of entry there becomes you have to package it back up and send it, and do that.
Yeah.
And that for some people is going to be too much trouble and they'll just end up keeping the thing that they maybe didn't love. But if people do it right, they'll make it so easy for you just to try it that you're not going to be worried they're trying to put one over on you. That's sort of the bargain or the agreement where you're like, I trust you because you've given me the opportunity to decide for myself and to not feel like I'm being tricked, but also to kind of maybe be tricked a little bit too.
You have manipulated me by making me feel as though I have agency, which I do, or do I? I think we could wrap up here, but there's a great point, something cool that Max found from a trade publication. Sampling also is a tide that carries all vessels. If you're giving away cheese samples, brie or maybe like bagels, a little smear of cream cheese on them by the dairy cheese aisles, then not only will that brand experience higher sales, but all the other cheese around there will. So you're kind of just raising the stakes for everyone.
And also, it's a really good play for the store itself, they don't necessarily care which cheese you buy as long as you buy it from them. So if a place, like we were saying with Trader Joe's, great strategy with free samples. Also, it's always free samples of their own stuff that they make.
Yeah,
so they're,
smart.
It's super smart. So you're like, you've got this brand loyalty to Trader Joe's, the store, and then you have this brand loyalty within Trader Joe's to Trader Joe's own products. They also sell some non-Trader Joe's products, but you know, that place is really designed to buy the stuff that they themselves make. We've got a pretty cool perspective on this from Todd Hollingshead from Brigham Young University. He had this to say, eating free samples at big box stores like Costco has become a weekend tradition for many shoppers. For adults with children, it's often the only way to get shopping done while maintaining sanity. But just how effective are free samples when it comes to actually attracting purchases and loyalty? After all, marketers spend more than $2 billion annually on sampling. New BYU research discovers the answer is a definitive yes. Just in case you needed non-anecdotal, you know, kind of, we know it works because it works on us, right?
Well, we know it works because it doesn't, I mean, this is a good segue. We know it works because it doesn't just stay in the realm of food. You can get free test drives, right? At car companies. Tesla will give you a free test drive. All you have to do is sign up at their website. You can get all kinds of free stuff, especially if you're scamming like I was back in the day, because companies want, first off, you usually have to give them your email or a mailing address. They'll send you stuff. And they'll keep sending you stuff. You know what I mean? Offers, sales, and so on. This is, I used to have a pretty big system for this. But at this point, maybe we ask people to visit us at Ridiculous Historians and give us some of their favorite free sample stories.
Mm-hmm. That being the old Facebook group. One last thing from the BYU study, though, and I think this is the good kicker here is, you know, companies spend tons of money on marketing of all varieties, whether it be like billboards or, you know, ads on bus stops or whatever, or like displays in grocery stores. The BYU research indicated that not only do free samples work, but the positive associations that you get from getting a free sample linger much longer than those in-store displays, however elaborate they might be. You know, we've seen like stacks of Coca-Cola cans spelling out "Go Dogs" or whatever, you know, and that's really impressive and everything, but that's not going to linger nearly as long as if they gave you a free can of Coke.
Well, it's because the sense memory is a much more powerful pathway for encoding long-term association, right? A display is visual and maybe sound, but if you can get, like, not for nothing did Proust become famous in literature for a taste of things remembered. It's all about how eating a Madeleine puts him in this crazy, crazy past experience. So yeah, when you're eating, when you're drinking, when you're consuming, remember, that's the way a memory can stay with you. You can also hack your own memory by doing this, folks. So play along at home. Tell us how it goes. Big, big thanks to super producer, Mr. Max Williams. Also, thanks for the surprising deep dive into free samples. And of course, thanks to Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. the Quister. Do you think he likes free samples? I don't know.
Of course he does.
You think so?
Of course he does. Who doesn't? If he doesn't, then he's even more of a reptilian creature than I give him credit for.
Mm-hmm. And thanks also to Christopher Hasiotis, Eves Jeffcoat, all the hits, Gabriel Luzier, our research associates, Dr. Z and Jeff B. And Noel, thank you to you. I guess a podcast is always kind of a free sample, isn't
it? Yeah, it is. It really is. You get the mattress. We'll give you the podcast, but you got to buy the mattress. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.